Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu, and this is On DoD. Today, an important topic across all government and something every agency has on their plate, privacy and civil liberties. In the Defense Department, those matters are handled by one office, the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. And our guest today is the director of the DPCLO, Michael Rehauser. Mr. Rehauser, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you, Jared.
So I think a good place to start probably is with the title of the office itself, which I guess in a way is two separate offices. We hear privacy and civil liberties in the same sentence all the time, but they're really two distinct topics, I guess. The privacy and civil liberties aspects of your job have different origins, different histories. You want to walk us through how those came to be managed under one office in DoD?
Certainly. The Privacy Act was passed in 1974, so the Department of Defense has been involved in privacy matters since that time. The civil liberties obligation is a more recent one. After 9/11, the 9/11 Commission reported that the Defense Department and other agencies were not doing as good a job as they needed to with information sharing. And they recognized that when we have more information sharing, we need to be very careful about ensuring that people's civil liberties are protected. So Congress passed a law that required the Defense Department and seven other agencies to establish civil liberties programs. When that requirement came down, the department asked a number of stakeholders within the organization as to where that civil liberties function should lie. And it was determined that the civil liberties function should be conjoined with privacy under the direction of the Director of Administration and Management for the Secretary.
And is that true across all agencies, that those two things are fairly conjoined?
Of the eight agencies, it's probably true in six of them. Some of them have slightly different approaches to it. But one of the things that was looked at is the statute itself conjoins the words privacy and civil liberties throughout. And there are a lot of commonalities between the topics.
Yeah, walk us through some of those commonalities. What do they have in common and what sets them apart in other ways?
Well, one of the most important things that both programs do is that it protects the individual. So what we look at, our office is responsible for being one of a number of organizations that review department-wide issuances and regulations to make sure that both privacy and civil liberties are protected. And the words privacy appear both in the Privacy Act as well as in the civil liberties legislation, but they are slightly different. The Privacy Act relates primarily to the collection of information about individuals that is maintained in a system of records by a government agency. So, for example, the collection of Social Security numbers is one that we're all familiar with. The right to privacy, which is a civil liberty, is a concept rather than a specific law. The Supreme Court has recognized that in the Constitution, there's a right to privacy, which also can be described really as the right to be left alone. Sometimes these two rights, the right to privacy and the Privacy Act, overlap as well.
Let's stay on privacy for a minute. When you're concerned about privacy, who are you primarily thinking about? Are you thinking about DoD and other government employees, or are you thinking of members of the public?
For the Privacy Act, we're concerned primarily with the DoD workforce. That would be our civilians, our military, and our contractor workforce. And what we do is we want to make sure that we have appropriate protections in place to guard their personally identifiable information. And Jared, you can think of that as information that links you to a particular set of data. So Social Security number is an easy one. Your date of birth and your last name together, perhaps your mother's maiden name, that sort of thing is what we're talking about here.
And let's start at the beginning on the Privacy Act. You said that that goes all the way back to the 1970s. You want to walk us through the genesis of that and maybe how that role for people who are concerned about privacy in federal agencies has evolved over time?
Certainly. One of the important things that happened in the 70s was the advent of computers, and there were a number of people that were concerned that the federal government was going to begin collecting data on people, maintaining secret files, and that sort of a thing. So the Privacy Act was passed to make sure that we had a set of fair information practice principles by which, as an example, anyone can find out what information the government maintains about them. And if it's wrong, they can petition to have it corrected. So as computers came into be more prevalent, the Privacy Act has not been amended, but it's broad enough to cover those changes in technology.
You said there's been no amendments to the Privacy Act itself. Has it evolved through a sort of regulatory process? How is the way we think about privacy changed since the 1970s? What are the issues that we're concerned about now compared to the issues we were concerned about in the 70s, if that has changed?
Well, the statute is broad enough to encompass a variety of administrative and technical changes that have happened over time. The big things that we were worried about in the 70s are not the things that we're concerned with today. If we think about the advent of social media and the ability for anyone to have information about almost anyone else in an instantaneous fashion is a completely separate issue than was considered some 40 years ago. But the act was broad enough, and the principles themselves are broad enough to cover even the advancing technologies that we have now. One of the big issues we are worried about is social media. And this really sort of dovetails into our civil liberties end of things. And that relates to how is it that we are going to have rules in place about what people can and cannot say on social media.
Walk me through how your office actually engages in the privacy sphere. What is it that you do? How does an issue come to you? How do you resolve it?
Our office is a policy office for the Department of Defense. We rely on the collaboration of every other component in DOD. There are more than 40 of them. If you think, for example, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps, you also have other organizations within DOD, the National Reconnaissance Office, the Contract Audit Agency. We run schools, we run commissaries, et cetera, et cetera. And we here in Arlington, Virginia, can't ensure that the Privacy Act is carried out in every one of those locations. What we do is we establish policies, and then we work very closely with our counterparts in those organizations that I mentioned to make sure that the rules and requirements are passed down to the individual soldier, sailor, airman, and marine, or civilian or contract employee that's working in these types of issues.
You mentioned the systems of record notices that are part of the Privacy Act. One of the jobs that we have at Federal News Radio, one of the more thankless ones, is to read through the Federal Register every day, and it seems like about half of the notices are probably System of Record Act notices under the Privacy Act. Those originate from your office, or they originate from the components, and what determines whether or not an agency has to issue one of those notices?
Well, the record notices originate with the components, but they come to our office for final review, and then we coordinate with the Federal Register official, who ensures that the Office of Management and Budget and other interested parties have the opportunity to review them before they're placed in the Federal Register for you and others to read.
They are
quite dry, but what they do is they ensure that the public is aware of where information that DOD has is being kept, how it's being secured, who has access to it, those sort of things.
And I assume that also goes to what you mentioned earlier about the Privacy Act. The public needs to be able to know what agencies know what information about themselves.
That's exactly right. We can't have any secret systems within the Department of Defense. We have to publish information about them so the public can access them. And as you point out, there are many of them. And for the average John Q. citizen, they don't really care. But there are a number of people that are intimately interested in these systems. So we need to have enough information out there that they can access the information and then determine whether or not there are any records being held about them, as an example, and make a petition to see what those records are.
If you are someone who is concerned for whatever reason that the Department of Defense might be keeping information about you that you might want to know about, is there any centralized place you can come to and say, what records do you hold about me?
What you're talking about, Jared, is a Privacy Act request, and that can certainly start in our office. Our website is dpclo.defense.gov. On there, we have a list of points of contact from any component, and primarily what would happen is that we don't keep the records ourselves here, but we can put the individual who's interested in that in touch with a point of contact at whatever component it is that holds that data so they can make the appropriate request there. Another way to do it is if a person knows, for example, that their records were maintained only by the United States Navy, they can go to the Navy website and there are points of contact there and there's a description of how to file a Privacy Act request. It's fairly straightforward and you will get a response back about what records are being held. There are certain records that are not provided to individuals, for example, law enforcement records in an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. So if you wrote in and said, I want to find out if NCIS is investigating me or targeting me, right, you're not going to get those particular files.
Right. And a member of the public or a member of the media who makes a request under the Freedom of Information Act, for example, one of the main exemptions to FOIA, I think, is the Privacy Act. How much interplay do you have with the FOIA process and with DOD components in that area?
Well, the exemption to FOIA that you're speaking about really relates to what's known as Exemption 6, which is personally identifiable information about an individual. And there was a balancing test between what the public wants to know and what the individual would like to know. And that's a more complicated analysis than we do in my office. We don't normally have a lot of interplay with that. I have familiarity with it from having worked on issues before. But our office really stays clear of that. The policy for that office is somewhere else in DOD.
Gotcha. We're talking with Michael Rehauser, the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. We'll talk some more about the Privacy Act when we come back and move into the civil liberties functions of the job. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbe. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. This week we're talking with Michael Rehauser, the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. We're talking about the Privacy Act right now. We're going to move on to the civil liberties function of the job in a little bit. But before we do make that transition, a couple things DOD is working on pretty intensively. One is the effort to reduce the use of Social Security numbers for various purposes. You were talking before about there are things we worry about now that we didn't worry about when the Privacy Act was drafted in the 1970s. I don't think people thought of Social Security numbers as a privacy threat back then. That's a fairly recent phenomenon, right?
That's right. With the ability of people to be able to take your Social Security number and combine it with other information that might be available on the web, it's fairly easy for people to steal others' identities or, at a minimum, to use their credit cards and other information to rob them blind, sometimes without them even knowing it. So what we're doing in the department is we're working with other organizations. My office doesn't have the lead on this, but we perform an important role, is to reduce the unnecessary uses of Social Security numbers. What we've seen across the department over time, the Social Security number has become the way that you get any information in DOD. And I know when I first started on active duty many years ago, we used to have our Social Security number printed on our checks. So when we went to the exchange or the commissary, they needed that information. It was there on the check, so you wouldn't have to write it down every time you needed it. And more recently, we've seen that at some posts and stations around the world that even to check out a volleyball, you needed to give the last four your Social Security number. So we've really gone way too far with the use of socials in DOD. And one of the things that we're working to do, along with other organizations, is reduce the unnecessary use of Social Security numbers. You're always going to need them for financial transactions and other identification, but we're trying to ask the components to look at all the systems they have and the forms they have that have the Social Security number embedded in it and say, do you really need the social, or is there some other mechanism we can use to identify an individual?
So in the components, is there a process generally by which if you're going to use a social for any particular purpose, you need to prove that there's a legitimate reason to use the social?
In the future, there will be, Jared, but there's not now. Now what has happened is that these systems have developed over time. We have certainly more than 1,000 of them within the Department of Defense that use the Social Security number. And we've asked the components to take a periodic review of those systems to really determine whether or not the social is necessary, and if not, what steps they'll take to remove it. Because sometimes it's not as easy as just taking it out, because different systems may be interrelated with each other. There may be second and third order effects of removing it from one system.
And just to get to the point of how recent this SSN reduction effort is, up until very recently, I know Social Security numbers were still printed on military ID cards for service members, on dependents. I think it was both the service member and the dependent Social Security number. I think a lot of people probably still have those in their wallets.
That's correct. And in fact, I am a retired Marine reservist, and my retired ID has my Social Security number on it. As people renew their identification, the social will not be put on there, but it does take time. As you know, we have more than 3 million people in the Department of Defense. If we include reservists, and many, many more retirees. So over time, we'll see the social coming off the ID cards.
And as you go through and look at, and as the military services go through and look at improper uses of Social Security numbers, were there any other huge glaring ones that came out as quick early candidates to remove?
Well, we haven't seen a lot of the data yet. We are working with other organizations, specifically the Defense Human Resource Activity, to come up with a plan that we can implement. It's all fine and good to say, here's our plan, but if it's not doable, not realistic, and the components haven't bought into it, we're not going to get very far. So we have not yet gathered enough data to say how easy reducing the Social Security number in some of these systems is going to be. But we're optimistic that we keep pushing at the problem that we'll get most of this solved.
And do we know if this has been a big problem? Are there incidents that you can think of where the use of Social Security numbers in places where they don't need to be used has resulted in a big PII breach that's been a problem?
Well, I can say that we have a number of breaches in the department. And I'm not certain that it's because the Social Security numbers are in the wrong places. I think what has happened primarily, the data that we receive here, is that most times it's an inadvertent use of a Social Security number. For example, when we send emails that contain multiple Social Security numbers, we're supposed to encrypt them. And there's a button right on the Windows program that you can click, and that encrypts the email. We found by the use of a new tool, a software tool, that we have a number of people that aren't following that guidance. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is we're sending Social Security numbers in the clear, and when we do that, we increase the likelihood that someone is going to be able to access that information.
Whether it's Social Security numbers or whether it's another type of personally identifiable information, what happens when DOD does discover a breach? How does your office respond? How does everybody else respond?
One of the things that we require the components to do is to notify our office when they've had a breach of personally identifiable information. Every week I get a report that I send to my superiors that shows all of the breaches that were reported to us. And they're all different kinds of things. We have emails that we discussed. We also have, for example, someone may have a laptop stolen out of a car, and the laptop has personally identifiable information of other people in a unit. We have paper records that get left behind when organizations move. We've had a number of organizations in DOD move as a result of the BRAC process. Mm-hmm. We had some go to the Mark Center and Fort Meade and other places. And sometimes when people move, they leave behind records that perhaps haven't been opened in a long time. And contained in those records, we've seen on occasion, Social Security numbers, dates of birth, that other type of information that if retrieved by someone with a nefarious purpose could really cause problems to our service members.
Social Security numbers is the one that everyone thinks of. Are there other examples of PII that are a problem that people need to be thinking about?
Well, the Social Security number is the easiest one to identify, but what people fail to consider sometimes is that because of the ability of the internet to gather data about you, you may think that information that's not a big deal, it can become a larger issue. For example, if you run in a race and your time is posted on the internet, you ran a 10-miler, and it's got your name and your date of birth. Now someone can, with that information, can find out perhaps where you live. So now they have your name, your date of birth, and where you live. It's much easier for them to open a bank account, as an example, if they can get your Social Security number and add it to that. Or if you think about the security questions you get when you open a bank account. What's your mother's maiden name? Where did you go to high school? What was your mascot's name? A lot of that information is on the internet now, and people don't think it's a big deal. But when you add it all up, it can become a big problem for folks. And frankly, I'm surprised we haven't seen a lot more identity theft.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting point, because it seems like so many of the hacks that we hear about lately aren't necessarily hacks where people go in and by brute force try to figure out your password. It's using, I think of the Sarah Palin example in the 2008 presidential campaign. It's just stuff that people know about you that's available on the internet. And it seems like something that pretty much everybody needs to be worrying about.
Right, well, that's now. Right. And you hear the phrase social engineering, where people use questions that don't seem like they're harmful in any way to gather information about you. And that sort of data can be a big problem.
Take another quick break here and we will come back. We're talking about privacy and civil liberties in the Department of Defense with the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office, Michael Rehauser. Back in just a minute, this is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu, and we're talking today with Michael Rehauser, the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. We've spent most of the first half of the show talking about the Privacy Act and how that relates to DoD and the activities of this office. I want to shift to civil liberties here, and you mentioned at the beginning of the show that the civil liberties is the newer hat of the two that you wear, and it was really born out of the information sharing requirements that agencies now have between each other that was realized after the 9/11 attacks. I believe you said that there are eight agencies that were statutorily required to create these civil liberties offices.
Correct.
Which makes me wonder how much interplay is there between DoD and those other eight agencies as far as sharing best practices, because you have obviously got to share information.
That's a great question. We have a number of interagency groups, and when I say interagency, I mean not necessarily every agency, but a group that gets together periodically and discusses best practices, policies, and issues that are coming to the fore. The White House also has a number of committees, several of which relate to privacy and civil liberties issues. So I have a good amount of dialogue with my counterparts in other organizations. They may not do things exactly the same way the DoD does. They may have more staffing in certain areas, less in others. But we all are committed to protecting civil liberties and privacy in accordance with the statutes.
And what are some of the issues that have come up in that time? I imagine that this art really has evolved over the past several years since this civil liberties function was created in agencies. What did you not know then that you know now?
One of the main things we're looking to do is educate the workforce that we're here. And I appreciate this discussion we're having today so that more people can know about our office. We had to start our program from scratch. Congress required DoD and the other agencies to do this, but didn't provide any funding for it and didn't provide any clear guidance as to how the agencies should carry out that mission. So the office was set up, and we started out with an idea that we needed to collaborate with all the other organizations in DoD. We thought we could not be directive in nature because we would get a lot of pushback on that. So what we did is we started out in small groups, meeting with individual stakeholders and the different components, and asking them what they thought would work based on the guidelines that we had put together. We have been in the process of drafting an instruction that will provide guidance to the department. That's nearly ready to be signed. I would expect it'll be signed in the next 30 days. And that will give an outline as to what each of the components must do. We have had a number of training sessions where we sit down with people within DoD and we explain to them this requirement and how they can use the existing processes they already have rather than to create new ones. We have very good report processes in DoD for EEO, the Inspector General, and others, and we didn't want to create a whole new layer of bureaucracy. We want to let those organizations do what they do, but then report to us as the statute requires so that we could notify Congress about any complaints we have as they relate to civil liberties.
And what do they report to you? What sorts of information?
We have been collecting reports for the past three quarters. The statute requires us to report each quarter to Congress. And from the components, we receive a short description of the assertion that someone has had their civil liberties violated in one manner or fashion. We then gather that information and we provide a report to Congress, which is available on our website, www.dpclo.defense.gov. And that lets the Congress and other interested people know what the kind of complaints we're getting. And what we're looking at then is, are there patterns that are emerging across the department that we need to train to? For example, are we finding a particular type of religious discrimination that is not in one component or another, it's across the department, that we need to educate people on? Have we had a lot of complaints about don't ask, don't tell? Have we had a lot of complaints about other freedom of speech issues? So to date, we're gathering this information and we're assessing it to see what we need to train across the department.
You said these reports incorporate the allegation that someone has had their civil liberties violated. Who, you know, adjudicates that? Who determines whether or not that claim is valid, and then what happens?
That's a great question. What we'd wanted to do, Jared, is not create a new process in place of the processes that are already there. For example, if a complaint comes into an inspector general, they have a very well-oiled process of how to investigate the complaint, what needs to be done, and so forth. We're not going to step in and say, no, do it a different way. Mm-hmm. What we ask is that the organizations, the components, investigate those complaints as they would in the normal course of business and then report that to us. And the determination of whether a complaint is there's going to be some action on it is left to the components themselves. For example, if the Air Force determines that the appropriate thing to do is to change a policy or to reprimand someone, or that it's unsubstantiated, we defer to that decision.
And I don't know how much visibility you have into whether those turn out to be substantiated or not on a case-by-case basis, but do you have a rough sense of how many do and how many don't turn out to be valid claims?
I do have a sense of that. A number of the complaints we've received so far are still under investigation. There is a fair number of them that have turned out to be unsubstantiated, mm-hmm. Particularly as it relates to some of our intelligence agencies where people make claims that, for example, the government put a tracking device in their tooth and is monitoring them from a spaceship someplace, those sorts of things. But for the most part, the complaints that we have received are valid complaints. There may not be a solution that makes the person happy in the short term, but they are investigated, and in many cases, policies are changed as a result of those complaints.
And is there you said you look for patterns, basically, between
yes.
all the other agencies. Have any of those patterns started to emerge? Is there a common thread between what are the most common, you know, civil liberties complaints besides, you know, microchips in teeth?
I would say, Jared, that I haven't seen any patterns that have caused me great concern. Mm-hmm. There are some patterns. Most of the complaints we receive relate to the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment. The First Amendment, of course, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. The Fourth Amendment is, in essence, no unreasonable searches and seizures. So what we have some complaints where people will say, well, the commander came to my barracks room and did an inspection. He wasn't allowed to do that. The freedom of speech issues may relate to anti-war activities where someone says I was punished for an anti-war activity. When the investigation is done, it turns out that the person was blocking, lying down across the metro entrance and impeding people coming back and forth,
right.
Where the protest area was 20 yards away and the person could have protested there validly. So, you know, each one of these stories has its own facts.
And the complainants can be someone from inside DOD and outside DOD in the examples that you just gave, right?
That's correct. And we have had a few that are outside DOD. Sometimes it's a service member who then either retains counsel or they talk to the press or another organization that's involved in civil liberties. And then that organization on behalf of the service member, perhaps anonymously, perhaps by identification, lets us know that this is an issue that they want addressed.
Mm. You mentioned an instruction that you expect to be signed within 30 days that's going to give an outline of what individual DOD components have to do on the civil liberties front. Can you give us a little teaser of what some of those things might be?
Well, the most important things that we think is that there has to be a person in the organization that is responsible for the civil liberties program. And that person has to be senior enough to affect change in the department, the organization. So we have asked that the person either be a general or an admiral, if a uniformed person, or a senior executive, if a civilian. Because we want to make sure that whoever it is, for example, if my assessment of the complaints is that we have a problem related to some issue, I need to be able to go to that person and say to her or him, this is a problem in your component. And that person then would have the ability and influence to change that policy.
And do you have a sense of whether or not those people, those general officers that you want to be in charge of civil liberties, have this issue on their radar screen sufficiently? And is that part of your job to get it there?
It is, Jared. That's a great question. We have spent the past year or so educating people in these senior positions. Most of the people we deal with are civilian senior executives, but we do have some that are uniform. And we have spent time training them, answering their questions, trying to help them establish their programs of civil liberties in their own organization. We have gone out to a number of groups, and we've provided training on what to look for. What are civil liberties? What are some of the issues we spot? What do you do when you get one? What's the process? How do you make sure that you're collecting enough information so that the person's claim can be adequately investigated, et cetera?
Take one more quick break here and come back. We are talking about defense privacy and civil liberties with the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office, Michael Rehauser. You're listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Our guest is Michael Rehauser, the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. And wanted to talk a little bit here about social media. The department has really had to adapt to and embrace the emergence of these platforms in a relatively short time for really both official and non-official uses. I think I probably follow about 100 different, DoD official Twitter accounts. So it's just the proliferation out there is amazing. And what specific new privacy and civil liberties challenges has all of that created? And what's your assessment of how DoD has met those challenges too?
I think the DoD is doing a really good job with the official social media sites. There are more than 1,500 Facebook sites that are official DoD sites. Mm-hmm. Some of them are only looked at by the members of that organization. Some of them have a pretty broad following. There are, of course, Twitter feeds, as you point out. There are all sorts of other social media that's official, and I think DoD is doing a good job with that. The challenge becomes how the department regulates or monitors the non-official sites. So if I'm deployed overseas and I write my mom and tell her that the Secretary of Defense was there this morning, and with him were 12 Navy SEALs, and she's excited about that, and she posts it, and now everyone in the world knows where the Secretary is and the fact that he's being guarded by Navy SEALs. An inadvertent sort of excited service member can cause a lot of operational security issues. Mm-hmm. In a war zone, it's a little easier for the commander to say to the troops, you can't do any posting, or significantly limit the number of posts that are there. The challenges we're seeing are back stateside. When does my freedom of speech collide with other issues that DoD is concerned about? For example, if I have a blog and I don't identify myself as a DoD person, but I am criticizing the administration's policies and I'm criticizing other things, and someone finds out about it, is there some punishment that can happen to me? Where are the lines? What can a commander say to a service member about what they can and cannot post when it really doesn't affect operational security? If a person is of the belief that don't ask, don't tell is a bad policy, are they allowed to say that on their own private blog? Mm-hmm. Are they allowed to say it if they identify themselves as Sergeant Smith? Well, probably not. But if they're not identifying themselves, where does DoD get involved there? And one of the issues that I think the entire department is struggling with is where that line is from the individual expression that people have the right to under the Constitution with the policies that we have here in the department. And I think that on the non-official sites, we're struggling with that.
And what's the answer to that? Is that something, in your view, that can be regulated, that you can develop a framework and put it out there and say, here's how we draw that line, or is this going to have to be up to each individual commander and we'll work through it as we go?
I think that there are certain guidelines that can be put out that could help, but it really does come down to the individual discretion of the commander, because not every circumstance is the same. I mentioned, if I'm deployed in Afghanistan, that's one thing. If I'm back in the U.S., that's a different one. But what if I'm aboard ship? What if I'm I'm overseas, but I'm not in a war zone? Are there different rules? It's very, very complex. So I think there have to be some guidelines about that that we haven't fully developed as a department, but the implementation and the assessment of them is really on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in theory a commander can just say no social media at all, but it seems like the message from all the military services and from DOD is, look, we know this genie is out of the bottle and it's not going back in.
That's correct, but you know, just some of the things that make sense, geo-tracking. Do you want to be posting pictures up that have geo-tracking software on it so that someone could see exactly where you are? We want to discourage that. So one of the roles we, not our office particularly, but the department as a whole has, is to make sure that people are educated about the technology and what can happen. And I think a lot of times we're in blissful ignorance about the ability of software programs to gather data and learn a lot more about us than we think they do.
Moving on a little bit, the amount of just information that passes through the Defense Department, usually in automated information systems, is, to say the least, enormous. How you have a relatively small office here. How do you decide where to focus your resources in that sea of information?
That's a great question. One of the things that we do is that we are a coordinating office for all department-wide regulations and issuances. And that gives us an idea about what's out there, what changes in policy are happening. We also collaborate significantly with our representatives and the components, both on privacy and civil liberties, and we rely on them to let us know what sort of issues are out there. We do our best to spot issues, but we really, it's incumbent on us to make good communication with those points of contact and find out what other things are out there. And then really what we do is we say, okay, what's the statutory requirements are X. That's the first thing we do. And then we look at department-wide requirements. That's the next thing we do. And then we focus our energy on training and education and new technologies and all that sort of thing. And I think you'll find if you walked around here, Jared, you would see that everyone is quite busy.
I understand. Broadly, we've touched on this a little bit, but how much of your focus and your mindset in the office is internal to DOD as opposed to external? Do you think of yourself as being primarily engaged in protecting service members and DOD civilians' rights, or are you looking out to the public and making sure DOD doesn't do anything untoward in that arena?
I think primarily we're focused internally. In a perfect world, we would have the ability to spend more time looking out. Right now, though, we are really working hard to comply with the Congress's requirements and the department's requirements, and that takes up almost our full-time job. We do have a lot of people in the office that are thinking about other issues besides the immediate day-to-day. We have some good long-term thinkers here, but our primary focus is within the Department of Defense.
In just a couple minutes we have left, I just wanted to ask you any major priorities and what's ahead for the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office that we maybe haven't touched on so far.
I think one of the things that we're looking to do is we're looking to solidify our civil liberties program by having the instruction signed. We also are looking to update our defense privacy directive and manual. And those two documents, when published toward the end of this year, will provide a lot more guidance to the department. We have a manual that is about 5 years old. It's still very good. Mm-hmm. But over time, we've seen that there are some areas that we need to improve upon. So these two documents on the privacy side will also assist the department greatly, in my view.
And any of those privacy updates that you want to share with us, some of the stuff that's fallen out of date, I guess, lately?
Well, I would say that most of it relates to how you respond to different incidents. Mm-hmm. So we have a good process, but sometimes it's not always formalized in a written document. Or we may have multiple documents that address the issue, and a privacy professional may not be able to go to one place to find that information. So what these two privacy documents will do is put the material in places where people can easily access them. The other thing we're working on is training. Both on the privacy and the civil liberties side, we've spent a lot of time and energy and effort on improving our training products. We most recently finished a small group privacy training, a 3-day training, where people had a hands-on exercise they could work through. And then we send these people back to their components where they can teach some of the same things that we taught them. So we're looking forward to making a big push this year in that direction.
How formalized are those training programs? Is there a curriculum that you've developed? How often does it happen, and who are those training programs open to?
The training programs are open to people in the Department of Defense, and mostly we focus on people that work in this particular specialty. We have a generic set of training that we do for privacy and civil liberties for the workforce, mm-hmm. but these more specialized training programs are geared to those people who have more complicated, sophisticated questions that we can help them answer. And the idea, too, is to develop a good working relationship so that when someone goes back to their organization, they can pick up the phone and they say, you know, you just taught me this 2 weeks ago and I have a question. And that sort of dialogue improves everybody across the board.
Great. It's been a really informative hour, Mr. Rehauser. Really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Thanks very much, Jared.
Our guest has been Michael Rehauser, the director of the Defense Privacy and Civil Liberties Office. If you missed any of our interview, you can listen to the whole thing at federalnewsradio.com. Search term on DOD. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.